Thanks very much, and it's I'm very pleased to be here. Loath though I am to spend time on conventional economic thought, especially at a meeting like this, it may be useful to begin today by reflecting briefly on why inequality and the study of inequality remained a backwater until quite recently. I think there are two reasons for this. One being institutional structures in the United States, as well as in Europe, that held income shares roughly stable in the early post-war period. And the other being a theory that focused on equilibrium states, in which, by definition, income shares would be stable. The evolution of inequality was therefore, practically by construction, either a short-run disequilibrium topic, and therefore intrinsically of only secondary interest, or else a matter of long-run structural change in structural characteristics of the economy, and therefore largely the preserve of economic historians. Either way, it was a backwater. Backwater status is not without advantages. Fresh water and salt water, the two alternatives, are notoriously sterile environments, and you can work undisturbed in a backwater for a long time before anyone notices, and the usual professional mechanisms of intellectual discouragement start to kick in. But a disadvantage in this case is that resources on a scale necessary to understand the issues, I think, properly, were not consistently applied to the gathering of data and to measurement. And so when the topic did begin to draw substantial interest, the evidentiary foundation was not strong. And this invited a theory-first approach. A literature which began to emerge in the 1980s and early 1990s that was based largely on a priori, apparently plausible hypotheses that drew such fashionable names as skill-biased technological change, as well as outsourcing and trade. And there was a, I think, distinct tendency in the literature to take very weak and preliminary evidence as confirmation of these a priori notions. This was an intellectual house of cards. In the immortal words that I once heard attributed, I believe, to Tallulah Bankhead, there was less there than meets the eye. The contribution of a team that I have been working with over many years now, actually, multiple cohorts of PhD students at the University of Texas, was to help fill the gaps in the empirical and historical record, showing that many sources of data could be harnessed to provide inequality measurements. In other words, there was raw material from which one could make contemporary measurements going back many years in many countries, so that we ended up in one variant of the work with a cross-country comparable data set of about 3,200 observations, each observation corresponding to a country and a year, going back to 1963 for overall something above 150 countries, with especially good and thorough coverage of inequality, specifically in the structure of wages. And therefore, application to problems which had not typically been the principal concern of scholars who had devoted themselves to research on inequality, for example, in the context of economic development or social issues, problems such as the effect of technology or the effect of trade on the structure of wages, and also problems such as the relationship between inequality, what one might also call labor market flexibility, and the employment outcomes in countries. What we largely found, and I have been making this argument now for many years, is that the study of inequality is very effectively constructed as a problem in global macroeconomics. That there were broad, see if I can get this come up, patterns which can be observed in the data. Looking at the national level, and I'll come to this in a second slide, we found that inequality is in part a curvilinear function of income level. Again, something you associate with macroeconomic phenomena. We found that the Kuznets curve, therefore, remains quite a good starting point for the study of inequality. And the Kuznets curve, the essential thing about it is that it relates inequality to income level as a matter of intersectoral transitions in the course of economic change. Kuznets' canonical case being the transition from agriculture to industry, but Kuznets was a very flexible and intelligent man. He certainly would not have restricted himself to that in the context of the world economy as it presently stands. And so one has to make a modification of the initial hypothesis in dealing with high-income countries. We also found that changes in economic inequality are driven substantially by changing economic structures, that is to say, by intersectoral changes in the distribution of employment, and by economic geography, that is to say, by the changing status of different places within countries, not surprisingly. But what that means is that when one has information available at relatively high levels of aggregation, you can extract from that information a reasonably accurate picture of what went on. We also found that looking at the movements of inequality across countries around the globe, that there is, in fact, a global common process at work, and that it would appear to be the case that changing financial regimes are the dominant force in that process. So let me give you quickly a picture of the stylized augmented Kuznets curve in a very simplified format, in which you can see the traditional inverted U with, let's say, China on an upward sloping component, a country like Brazil or Korea on a downward sloping component with much deeper processes of industrialization, and then a upward sloping tail for the very highest income countries, which are supplying advanced capital goods and financial services to the world economy. And the phenomenon that one observes over much of the time period that we see is, in fact, rising, now this line is not properly placed, but rising income in the richest countries and rising income in China, but also recession in as a result of the debt crisis in much of the industrializing world. And the consequence of that would be rising inequality virtually everywhere as all the countries move in adverse directions along the curve. There is also, I think, a very clear in the data pattern of global movement of inequality. And the broad picture is something which is strongly suggestive of a concept that I heard actually from George Soros at one of these meetings a couple of years ago, of a super bubble beginning in with the world debt crisis in the early 1980s and coming to a peak in 2001. And I'll talk a little bit about what happened since, but let me first of all just show you what the data appear to show for this period from 63 through 2002 when we have a substantial body of completed work. This is a time series which is constructed entirely artificially, extracted from a large panel data set of measures of inequality in industrial wage structures around the world, this 3,200 observation data set. And these are the time dummies associated with the common movement of inequality across countries in that data set. And what you find is a relatively stable period in the 1960s, comes to an end in the early 1970s. There's a period of declining inequality associated with the commodities boom and the run-up in debt in the third world in the 70s, a massive turnaround in the early 1980s associated, I believe, with the onset of the debt crisis. It's certainly clear if you look country by country that inequality rises as countries are overtaken by their debt problems. Spreads around the world from Latin America through Central Europe and on into Asia, and peaks in 2000 with the peak of the NASDAQ and then with the 9/11 crisis in the United States. If one looks at another measure attempting to capture the inequality, this is Branko Milanovic's work, measuring the inequality, is so-called, I think, concept, this is concept one or concept two, concept one inequality, which is inequality measured between countries using PPP adjusted average income levels, and one of them is the world and the lower one is the world without Africa. What you find is that they show the same turning points and the same surge after 1980. So it's very interesting and perhaps not surprising that a measure completely independently taken, one of which is based upon the differences between rich countries and poorer countries, and the other one of which is based upon inequalities inside countries, show a very similar time pattern and movement, right? And a third measurement, which is associated, was done by Olivier Giovannone, now at Bard College, is a measure of the profit share in the OECD countries, and you find that it also has the same time pattern, the same turning points. So this again gets to the question I think that you were mentioning in your paper, what is the relationship between these phenomena? And it seems to me at least you can make out a pretty strong case in principle that they are in fact the same thing. That one says simply finding different ways to measure the same phenomenon across different observational frames. The significance of globality, of the common global pattern, is, I think, quite simple, but it bears some reflection. It rules out something that would be, let's say, slowly diffusing, such as the spread of a technology around the globe, or education, with different patterns in different countries. It rules out national autonomy as the major source of changes in inequality, with some very limited exceptions, and there are exceptions. China and India are remarkable exceptions in the 1980s, which is not surprising considering they were insulated from the global debt crisis. So it rules out, I think, asymmetric phenomena such as trade. Therefore runs against the hypothesis that was advanced in the 1990s by my tutor and friend Adrian Wood. So it suggests, in fact, that there is a common global force behind the changes in inequality everywhere, almost everywhere, and for this one would need a common global policy explanation. And if that is the case, it seems to me that we'll ask what kind of policies affect the world. Surely financial policies, changing financial regimes, matters such as the movement of interest rates from effectively negative in real terms to 20% in the early 1980s and then the peaking in 2000, strikes me as at least a very plausible culprit in what we observe. A second broad area where we can do interesting empirical work here, and I don't have slides on this for this presentation, but I'll just talk about it, but where we have reliable information on employment and unemployment alongside common patterns of inequality, we find that in general, countries which have relatively compressed wage structures that are relatively egalitarian in the way in which they contrive to pay their workforces have employment experiences which are better, which are associated with less, not more, unemployment. So we find that the evidence here runs flatly contrary to a piece of doctrine associated, which could broadly describe as the idea that increasing wage flexibility, increasing labor market or decreasing labor market rigidities is going to produce better employment results. The evidence suggests that this is in fact not the case, One looks inside Europe, the countries with the more compressed wage structures have systematically better unemployment records. And there is, of course, one has to, in examining this problem, make the comparison between Europe and the United States, which has always been the foundation of this particular argument. But the case that I would make, and one thing that we can do with this data, taking advantage of the very particular way in which the calculations of inequality are made, is that one can ask, what is the appropriate level at which to compare the European experience to the American one? The characteristic habit has been to use country data because we have countries as observations, and therefore to compare Denmark to the United States, a comparison which is profoundly unfair. Denmark having 5.9 million people, protected by a cold climate. I say cheese-eating social democrats by tradition. If you want 5.9 cheese-eating social democrats in the United States, you can go to Wisconsin, and that's exactly what you will find. 5.9 million is the population of Wisconsin and has some Denmark. And it has a social democratic tradition, and it's more egalitarian than the United States. The argument I would make is that since Europe has largely integrated with respect to capital flows, for example, and therefore from the standpoint of a multinational corporation or an investor choosing its portfolio, it's a common area, it's appropriate to make an inequality comparison at the continental level. In which case you have to add in the inequalities between countries, the difference between Germany and Poland or between Germany and Portugal becomes relevant. And when you do that, you discover that it's not the case that pay structures in the United States are less equal than they are in Europe. On the contrary, because the between country inequalities are big inequalities across big distances, but if they matter, and arguably they do, they are greater in Europe than they are in the United States. Okay, there is, and then a similar relationship that that shows up in China as well, by the way, as inequalities increased. And if you were in the other session, you saw some measures of that, but particularly the cities versus the countryside, the coast versus the interior. You find that, of course, the direct effect of that is a massive pull on internal migration. And the consequence of that is a very much increased unemployment experience for the migrant populations who are coming in looking for jobs that they get only sporadically, and otherwise they are unemployed. So I would argue that this provides the basis for a fairly substantial empirical argument that would tend to be a fairly useful confrontation with a lot of received policy wisdom. Let me, here's the super bubble in all cases. Okay, move on. A final set of observations that I want to present today deal with the United States. And again, very closely related to some things that we've seen in the previous presentation, in which we're looking now at income inequality measured from tax data. I find, and I don't have a slide to show here on this, that measures of wage inequality in the US are largely driven by unemployment. Measures of income inequality, which include non-wage incomes, are very, very closely associated with the stock market. Why would this be so? The effect on taxable incomes of a very small group of people, of their stock options, their capital gains, the incomes paid from IPOs and so forth, particularly in the run-up of the information technology boom in the 2000s, is extremely closely associated with measures of inequality. You can do this with any kind of measure of inequality and get a roughly similar result, but this one, there's a little bump on the Tax Reform Act of 86 for reasons I don't want to go into, but the obvious peak at the peak of the super bubble is very, very close associated with the NASDAQ, and you can see it in logs that it's not just that the peak is the same, but the proportional gains are the same. So what are we looking at? We're looking at people reporting their incomes from these stock market valuations. And when you can, since this is a measure actually taken between counties from tax data, you can isolate the counties that are associated with this. And what you find is if you take out one, you get a substantial reduction of inequality. That's Manhattan, New York, has contributes by itself a fairly significant effect. Take out four more, and the four are Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Francisco in California, and King County, Washington, which is Seattle, and about half of the rise of inequality over the 1990s to 2000 goes away, measured between counties. Take out the top 15, and it all goes away. So we're looking at a phenomenon that was experienced in only very indirectly by most Americans, five counties out of 3,150. Okay. All right. So it's dramatic that this is such a concentrated phenomenon in the movement of income inequality. If you can want to look at this, in the late 2000s, one can measure the contribution of each county to inequality. Using the elements of a tie statistic, and again, you can see the singular importance of particular places. And an interesting fact about this is that the places move around. They don't always show the same pattern from year to year. In the middle 2000s, it's Washington, D.C., which is a dominant force in the rise of inequality in 2003 to 2007. A little bit later on, you can see a very big effect in Southern California and Southern Florida. So there you have singular evidence of the housing bubble, of the subprime debacle in the making, and those that will have gone away from by now. I think the policy implications of this are reasonably straightforward, and I won't dwell on them. They are, I think, point to the importance of social insurance as a moderating force. They point to the importance of financial discipline, regulation, surveillance, as a regulating force. They point to the limitations of an economy whose growth model is driven by bubbles. There are limitations on this research. It obviously does not begin to deal with some of the larger issues in environment and climate and energy that we were talking about in the previous session. The data do not speak directly to important ongoing concerns such as gender and race. Although they are not entirely silent, one has to be, I think, quite careful about drawing inferences, but then again, the composition of our panel did not speak very effectively to these issues either. What I would say by way of final conclusion is that the central point I would try to make in this work is that the study of inequality is the study of instability. That's what it is. That's what it's about. And so I offer this body of evidence not mainly for political or ethical reasons as such, although there are some political and ethical implications, but because it provides an example of a data-driven, theory-consistent, macro-financial monetary basis for economic research and for an integration of what has been traditionally a microtopic inequality with the macro problem of economic instability. So that, if you want to choose a fairly far-reaching word to describe this, might be a paradigm, so to speak. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I don't want unequal treatment, so if there are questions now,